Earthlings have a new neighbor. The Journal of Astrophysics reports the discovery of an Earth-sized exoplanet orbiting a star about 11 light years away. And they say it might meet basic requirements for life. If that is true, a new Chinese telescope might be the one to make first contact. The huge radio telescope is in the karst mountains of southwestern China. It's 5 football fields wide, deep enough to hold 2 bowls of rice for every person on the planet. It's as though God has pressed a perfect round fingertip into the planet's outer crust and left behind a smooth silver print. So writes Ross Anderson, science editor for The Atlantic. He recently toured the new telescope, a facility that will scan billions of wavelengths across billions of stars looking for a beacon. Ross, beautiful writing. And a beautiful place, so remote, your driver wanted to turn around and your GPS stopped working?
It was a bit of a journey to get there. I mean, first of all, it was just quite a long haul to get to Shanghai. And then a long but pleasant and fast train ride to the southwestern countryside to a city called Guiyang, one of the more remote and poorer provinces in China. It was quite a drive from there. We had this 4-hour drive away from Guiyang, and I think after hour 2, we never had a reliable account of where we were. So it was nutty.
And then you finally find this huge bowl, as you write, large enough to hold bowls of rice for everyone in the world, surrounded by these mountains which look like snaggletooths, you know, coming up from the earth. Very, very dramatic. So let's back up. How did we get here? How do we get to the point where China might, in fact, make first contact with extraterrestrial life and has this huge facility? Because as you write over China's history, and you take us, you know, very in depth, even though they have the oldest culture of astronomy in the world, they were often very behind in science.
So if you were to sort of pick a year at random out of the last 4,000 years, out of a hat, odds are China was going to be at the sort of scientific and technical vanguard or very close to it. It is only in the past few hundred years that China has fallen behind, and now it is busily trying to even the score, I guess.
Yeah, catch up but also pass. Now the country on the pace to outspend the U.S. on R&D in this decade. And yet we should note, too, that the U.S. also kind of fell behind in this particular race, the search for aliens, about 25 years ago when it was defunded by the government. There was this sense of it was Martian hunting.
Yes. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was defunded. And you had a couple things going on there. For one, it was the early 1990s. Newt Gingrich's Republicans had just been elected and taking control of Congress, and they were in a spending-cutting mood and sort of looking for things that were easy to beat up upon. And I think after a kind of long golden age, when Carl Sagan sort of first rose to prominence, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence was sort of this romantic activity that people were really excited about. But the fact that this search might take quite a long time indeed was starting to sink in right around the time politicians were looking for easy targets for funding cuts. And so SETI was defunded at the government level. And to their great credit, Jill Tarter and some people at the SETI Institute in Northern California really tried to soldier along with generous gifts from donors. But it was never the same. And China is sort of coming into its own scientifically, unencumbered by that cultural baggage, at a time when we have discovered all of these planets around neighboring stars, when all of a sudden SETI's starting to look like quite a good idea again. And so being able to start from scratch, they're like, hey, you know, we're going to build a big radio dish. Of course it's going to be interested in SETI.
SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And yet you talk about how there's a lot of cross-pollination between countries. Now, today, you've got the Russian billionaire Yuri Milner pouring hundreds of millions of his own money into the SETI program at UC Berkeley. And then you've got UC Berkeley's Andrew Simeon helping the Chinese build this dish. What do they do with it?
One interesting thing, and this gets back to the tension in this piece where China is sort of running ahead in science but also still trying to catch up, there's no one in the Chinese scientific firmament that can manage an observatory of this size and complexity because there's never been one there. And so they're currently looking for a director for the telescope from abroad. And so, yes, they're involved in several international partnerships, including with Andrew Semyon's Berkeley Group.
Well, and you have one of the best science fiction writers, well, some would say in the world, but definitely in China right now. Who is Lu, and why was he at the dish?
He, you know, he's quite a celebrity in China, especially whenever sort of cosmic subjects are being discussed. He actually consults for the government on aerospace missions, and they're sort of eager to play upon his reputation for being quite a broad thinker, someone like an Arthur C. Clarke or a Carl Sagan here in the United States.
Yeah.
I thought it would be really interesting to talk to him about some of the kind of deeper philosophical questions around what it would be like to open up a dialogue with an alien civilization.
And by the way, Barack Obama, as you write, told the New York Times that Lu Xixin's books gave him cosmic perspective during his presidency. Lu told you his Obama staff asked him for an advance copy of the third volume. So he's widely read around the world. What does he say about potential first contact?
He seems to regard it as quite a dangerous thing. You know, he has a character spouting this dark forest theory, which basically says that no civilization should announce its presence to the cosmos, because if there are aliens waiting out there, they're probably going to be looking to eliminate any threats to their future, and any other civilization would be regarded as such a threat.
The thinking is that anyone we would make contact with would be older and maybe wiser. And Lu says, you know, he's given this a lot of thought, would have hidden themselves.
Yeah, that's correct. So SETI researchers, I think, take it for granted that anyone we made contact with would be more advanced than us, for the simple reason that we've only just stumbled on radio technology. So if you have some distribution of civilizations in the galaxy, the odds that they would be as young, so to speak, as us would be quite slim. And I make the argument in the piece that to survive on cosmic timescales, whether that's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, potentially even millions of years, that maybe that would lead you towards some more peaceful behaviors. Maybe you would learn to be tolerant and not, you know, rush to invade or eliminate any civilization that you might encounter, but
yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. You dive deep into what might possibly be out there. It might be a post-biological artificial intelligence that had taken control of its planet. So it might have transformed its entire planet into a supercomputer. And according, these are Oxford researchers you're quoting now, it might just have shut itself down to sleep hundreds of millions of years until, you know, the time is right to come out. You write, you know, these are radio waves. Radio waves are the weakest form of electromagnetic radiation. The collective energy of all the radio waves caught by Earth's observatories in a year is less than the kinetic energy released when a single snowflake comes softly to rest on bare soil. You know, beautiful sentence, but really? Is it going to be that hard?
Yeah, they are radio waves are quite ethereal. They are soft whispers that sort of fly across the universe, and all kinds of astronomical phenomena give them off. So black holes give them off in great magnitude, and, you know, stars even give them off. But teasing out the ones that might be from an intelligence could prove quite difficult.
Yeah. Well, you tease apart all sorts of theories about why we haven't found a single civilization, despite having searched 100,000 galaxies. But here are these people investing billions of dollars in this. Does anybody say, well, maybe there's just nothing out there?
Sure. I think that responsible scientists will always have the null hypothesis in mind. However, it's certainly the truth that we've looked at only a fraction of the sky, at only a small fraction of the frequencies. So I would say it's premature to conclude now that there is no one out there, but it's definitely a live option. I find it quite persuasive that, you know, in each galaxy, of which there are more than 100 billion in the observable universe alone, there are hundreds of billions of stars. And in just the last 5 years, we've had this really a new kind of scientific revolution where we've discovered that nearly every star that we look at in our galaxy has planets around it. So that's a whole lot of laboratories where life may have evolved. And, of course, there are many, many steps between evolving, say, a single-celled organism and something as complicated as a human being that can point a dish up at the night sky. But I'm hopeful, I guess.
What was it like to be there?
It was incredible. As I say in the piece, the thing that really took my breath away first was the mountains. And in the foreground, you just have this massive, you know, kind of brand new sparkling silver dish. It was gorgeous.
And I can't imagine you didn't think, you know, do it now. Come now. Let's hear let's hear from you.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I'd like to be like Jodie Foster, you know, with the headphones on.
Right. That's Ross Anderson, science editor at The Atlantic. He recently turned the brand new alien-seeking facility in China. We'll link you to his writing at hereandnow.org. Ross, thank you so much.
Robin, thank you.